Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hey, Dr. Santosh here, pediatric infectious disease doc, researcher, you know the drill.
And joining us this week is friend of the show and pharmacist, Eleanor O'Rangers.
Hello.
Woo! And we should say, rightful host of her own show, Space Medicine.
Yes, exactly. We just kicked off our fourth season. So you'll have to take a listen. I have to edit part two of our kickoff episode tomorrow.
Yay! Oh my God, I love it.
Honestly, it's out of this world. This week, I figured it might be fun to take a little deep dive and start our holiday season of stocking stuffers. Shorter episodes, but no less fun. And you might be wondering, why, other than her charming personality, would we invite a pharmacist on to this episode? Unless, of course, the topic was a drug.
Dun, dun, dun. Yay! Drugs!
By the way, for all of you guys who did not read the title of this episode, you got the joy from that little segue. Thank you for that.
Segues. I will not commit to them. This week, we're going to be going into the history of aspirin. And I know what you're thinking. Of course, it goes all the way back to Hippocrates and willow bark for pain relief. And as much as I would love to claim ancient Greece and will, it wasn't Hippocrates who really used willow bark. And I don't know that he's a direct link in the chain for the discovery of aspirin. So let's talk a little bit about the history of aspirin, how it works, its discoveries, and all the many fun things that it does.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds good to me.
So-called father of medicine.
Yeah.
Is said
modern Western medicine as of this recording.
Yeah.
Hippocrates is said to have used willow for pain relief, which later led to the development of aspirin. But when you actually look back at the writings of Hippocrates, they barely mention willow. So where does this come from? I mean, he prescribed willow to women in labor. Now, the exact method was a little unclear. Some accounts say it was leaf tea. Others say chew willow bark. But the only records we actually have available, there's just one reference to burning willow leaves to make smoke for fumigating the uterus. And that was to get rid of a miscarried pregnancy.
Kind of like, I guess, burning sage.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Hippocrates was a giant hippie.
Exactly.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay, I see what you did there.
It's terrible. Actually, stuff that had salicylates in it, so willow trees and other stuff. And I'm surprised you didn't do this. I guess there is, it does go back even further than Hippocrates to another beloved time of yours.
Oh, are you talking about it being used by the ancient Egyptians in the Ebers Papyrus? I was actually going to grant you one episode without an Egypt mention. That was a Christmas gift to you.
Why would I want to do that? No. So the I love this. The truth of the matter is, when you have something that's mentioned so far back in history, so you're getting back to Ebers Papyrus. When was that? How far back is that?
Oh, somewhere around 3000 to 2300 BC.
Damn. Okay. All right. Gotcha. So you've got stuff that has salicylates in it. So these are willow trees, and you've got other ones. And, you know, it's gone through to Hippocrates, which is what? 5th century BC, right? So that's a huge amount of time to bridge. That probably means that this was common usage. So even though it wasn't part of a text or something, it was probably something that like your average farmer or someone knew about, you know, like if you were aching and soaring, like at the end of a day, you'd chew some willow or something.
Well, that's the thing. When you're talking about the bark of white willow, and here's where Eleanor's expertise will begin to come in handy. Salix alba, which is what Hippocrates and possibly even the ancient Egyptians were talking about, just doesn't contain a lot of salicin compared with other kinds of willow or plants. So to get a clinically effective dose, and I'll let Eleanor explain what that is, but just chewing bark or drinking willow tea would be unlikely to give you an effective dose of medicinal aspirin.
No, probably more fiber than medicinal aspirin.
The real Greek who got into herb lore was another botanist. And you know, Santosh, I think this is going to be a running gag.
Okay. All right. I'm braced.
Well, I mean, we're just seeing so many botanists take root on this show. But I feel like the joke has been firmly planted.
I mean, you know, now that it's blooming.
But Pedanius Dioscorides was a Greek who grew up in Rome and wrote a guidebook of medicines still in print today. And he's the one who really went into the many uses of willow, and he described it as a remedy for stomach ache, also for the respiratory disease tuberculosis, as a contraceptive. Look, he made perhaps a few errors, yeah. His claims.
Well, if we're talking about salicin or salicylates, I'll actually ask Eleanor, does some of this jive with what salicylates can do? I mean, because it has such a wide array of targets chemically. Right.
Well, I mean, certainly the anti-inflammatory properties, that's really what sounds like historically it was primarily used for. But let's also not forget its antipyretic properties, its fever reducing properties. I'm sure I'm going to assume that some people may have recognized that back in the day as well.
Well, he was in fact a physician in the Roman army and wrote De Materia Medica, a 5-volume Greek encyclopedia about herbal medicine. So one of the very first pharmacopoeias that has never gone out of print in the last 1500 years or so.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Damn.
Yeah, damn.
So
that's kind of like Grey's Anatomy, yeah. You know, going all the way back.
Or just, Starbucks.
Or Starbucks.
Well, you know, speaking of going way back and still around today, you know, willow bark is still sold as an herbal as well. And I know that my nail technician's mom was asking me questions about these really strange, round dark pellets that she got when she was in Vietnam. And when I kind of figured out what they were, it was actually willow bark that was compounded in these little pills. There's definitely still has a role in Chinese medicine and or in traditional herbal medicine.
Cool.
Well, a lot of the annotations in prints from the 13th and 12th centuries helped to serve as a Rosetta Stone for plants, for about 600 different plants in all, with languages that have fallen out of use. So they're like, oh, well, the only reason we even know this tribe had access to this plant is because there's a name for it, you know, five or six names. This was, again, a pharmacopoeia, a Wikipedia, and all done still by a Greek. So, you know, I feel slightly mollified. But when we talk about who actually discovered willow as a medication, it's English cleric Reverend Edward Stone, known by his friends as Edmund. Around 1757, cleric Stone chewed on white willow bark, I don't know, out of curiosity, just hunger. He chose some reason to just be like, tree bark. And he was struck by how bitter it was. Now, he followed this train of thought to a very different station and wondered whether it could be used medicinally like the bitter cinchona bark, where the malaria drug quinine comes from. And we have talked about the medicinal gin and tonic. And if you haven't been listening to the show for a while, we'll throw that up. We'll throw that episode up later this month. So listen to... Well, first, he gathered and dried around half a kilogram of willow bark. And when I say dried it, he dried it for over 3 months in a bag on the outside of a baker's oven. I guess he was just leaving it on the sill like a pie. Pounded and sifted it. And then, next time he had a fever, he dosed himself using tiny amounts, but then as he found it wasn't poisoning him and actually made him feel better, increased the dose. Now, Eleanor, before we go into his letter and things, I want to talk to you about doses. Mm-hmm. He increased the dose by 2 scruples. How many scruples go into most modern medicines?
Oh, my. Boy, that's getting back to, like, my pharmacy school days where we had to learn about drams and all that stuff.
So are you telling me you've had no scruples since pharmacy school?
I had no scruples since pharmacy school.
I love that you know this, because at first I thought Josh was just throwing out another like weird ass obscure thing like cubits or
all this. I hated that in school because it was so it was antiquated. But yeah, I mean that's the way scruples, grains, and drams were the ones that I remember. And actually a scruple is 20 grains. And one medicine I always remember that traditionally was dosed as grains was actual desiccated thyroid. And I remember that because my mom takes did take thyroid for a long time. And she took like the desiccated thyroid and it was 5 grains.
We also used to see arsenic dosed in grains. What is a grain in today's measurement, Eleanor? Because most people, I think, are going to picture like, oh, it's just like, you know, a tiny little pebble or a grain of sand or something like that. How accurate is that?
I want to say it's like 65 milligrams or something like that. Yeah, it's like 65 milligrams.
Yeah, so that's at least a little spoonful of sand.
Yeah, exactly.
Not just that. So a grain's still quite a lot. Now, a scruple is 1/24 of an ounce or about 1.25 grams. So the next time somebody asks you, have you no scruples, you know exactly what they're weighing it as.
Or you could say, well, I don't have a scruple, but I have 20 grains, which is actually the same thing as a scruple.
Oh, we're going to have so much fun with measurement.
That's a great pull for this episode, Josh. Fun with measurement. We're going to have people subscribing in droves.
Hey, I will have you know that we do have people subscribing in droves.
And they do, and they're all here for the old scruples to grains to grams conversion.
Take that, metric system. So when he had the fever, he ended up taking small doses every 4 hours, and drying the bark as he did would have actually concentrated the salicin, making it even stronger. So when the powder relieved his fever, he then tried it just for kicks on his parishioners when they were sick, which, you know, a lot of local priests were the doctors for their villages. And then after these non-blinded trials, he wrote to the Royal Society saying it worked, and I have a copy of the letter. Imagine one of those The Crown soundtracks in the background, or like a Downton Abbey voiceover.
Yeah.
And then he goes, "My lord, among the many useful discoveries which this age hath made, there are very few which better deserve the attention of the public than what I am going to lay before your lordship. There is a bark of a certain English tree that I have found by experience to be a powerful astringent, and very efficacious in curing aguish and intermitting disorders. About 6 years ago I accidentally tasted of it, and was surprised at its extraordinary bitterness, which immediately raised me a suspicion of it having the properties of the Peruvian bark. As this tree delights in a moist or wet soil where agues chiefly abound, the general maxim that natural maladies carry their cures with them, or their remedies lie not far from the cause, was so very apposite to this particular case that I could not help applying it, and that this might be the intention of Providence here, I must have had some little weight with me. He then goes on to describe how he prepared the bark, and how after it worked, you know, on a Q4 to 6 hour dosing, he then dosed his parishioners, and everybody turned out okay. So, happy tales.
Well, wow. I'm glad everyone was all right. I love this. These old stories are fantastic. They're just, this was done with good intention and all this kind of a thing, but holy crap, would this not pass ethics board?
Exactly. Where is the IRB?
Oh, they, you mean the Royal Society? That's who we sent the letter to. And after that, they began to advise willow bark in some herbals, and pharmacists began trying to extract salicylic acid from willow bark and meadowsweet. Now, fun etymology fact, meadowsweet is the Latin name at the time was spiraea, which, do you see where this is going?
I think I knew where this was going.
Well then, by all means, feel free to jump in and tell us where aspirin was named from.
We have to fast forward a couple of years. I mean, there were some other people doing experiments with salicylates and salicin and all sorts of good stuff. And then finally, dun 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 dun, 1897, German chemist Felix Hoffmann from the Bayer Corporation actually developed aspirin. He actually chemically synthesized it. And how he named it comes from the chemical components that he used to put it together. So A in aspirin stands for acetyl, because he that was part of the composition of the molecule. And spear is derived from the spiraea plant, or meadowsweet, which contains salicin. And in was a suffix that was commonly used for drugs at the time of the first stable synthesis of the compound. So aspirin, there you go.
Around the same time and up till 1950, which will be another important date later, there was also the use of chewing gum, which began to have aspirin as a component, and it was named Asper Gum because had all the same starts, but gum. However.
I actually have tried that. It was manufactured for a long time.
Oh, wow.
Let's take a quick detour to talk about aspergum.
Is this a detour onto like eBay for like collector's edition? Are we going to find some packet somewhere in a, like in a, what do you call it? In a Topps baseball card pack?
Well, believe it or not, I'm just looking it up on Wikipedia, which of course is, you know, my only standard go-to for drug information. It actually contained 3.5 grains of aspirin.
And was available in cherry and orange flavors.
Ooh.
I actually remembered taking aspergum as a kid.
The reason I wanted to tie back is chewing gum has been around just as long as aspirin. The ancient Greeks were known to be fond of a gummy substance named mastich, derived from the resin of the mastic tree. In fact, this is where you get the first uses of the word masticate, because of the chewing you had to perform on this gummy substance. And you know who first wrote about this plant? Why, Greek, Roman physician, and medical botanist of the first century, Dioscorides.
Tying it all together.
So he recommended chewing mastic resin, so a little bit of this plant combined with beeswax, which was a softening agent, and that was sort of the very first gum, and then we take this all the way forward to, 1924 is when you first started seeing medicated aspirin chewing gum. Gum with aspirin in it, for, you know, those of you who don't like pills, was still being sold until 2006.
There you go.
And this was over the counter. This wasn't
in cherry and orange flavor. Yep. Like
now over the counter, carried around by Barbra Streisand and other celebrities of the day. However, good news, folks, as of January 2016, Retro Brands USA plans to relaunch the Aspergum brand. Wow. No word on if they're going to measure it in grains, drams.
Or minims.
Or,
that's another one.
Minims or scruples. I don't know if Retro Brands has scruples. Well, I guess we'll have to find out.
So the worry's going to be here that, like, someone decides to chew 5 sticks at once. Yeah. And something really bad happens.
One of the biggest things I would be immediately concerned about with that would be just stomach irritation from that. Because, you know, aspirin, of course, well, we know you can have coated aspirin to try to reduce gastrointestinal distress. But I don't think aspergum has any protection from that. So probably acute stomach gastritis is the thing I would be most concerned about. But the other issue that I always think about with aspirin, if you take too much of it, is ringing in your ears, tinnitus. So I don't know if, but that I think is usually with chronic use that you can get in the ears.
So rather than a high dose, you know, taking it over a long period of time.
Yeah, that's what I usually think of. It's just chronic. All right. Of course, the only thing I keep thinking of is whenever I think of tinnitus is this cartoon of a doctor with a patient, you know, sitting on a medical examination table, and it's actually, you know, one of those Harlequin guys, and he has like one of the Harlequin hats on with the bells, and the patient's like saying something like, yeah, I don't know, I just keep having this like weird ringing in my ears, and it's because he has a stupid hat on. So that's what I would say.
I will bring up I know we're going to probably talk about the acute effects later, but in pediatrics, this was a big deal. We don't fully understand why, but there was this syndrome called Reye syndrome.
Yeah.
And so if you, for instance, gave some aspergum to a kid, and very specifically, if they had certain respiratory viral illnesses like influenza, chickenpox, which thankfully, because of vaccination, is a gone thing. These kids would take aspirin. They'd be given aspirin for fever. But if, for instance, they had this and they would chew aspergum, they could get this really bad encephalopathy. So they would be confused and almost like hallucinating. And it could actually really damage their liver very, very acutely. So it was actually very quickly recognized that, oh, you can't give this to a kid. But if aspergum was around, I'm a little scared that this could happen. So that's one that I definitely think about with
you're just saying that aspirin. Because local pharmacies were the literal candy stores of their day.
Well, and some of them, I guess, still are. We have a few throwbacks here where, you know, we have a pharmacist with a soda fountain.
Who can take a sunrise, sprinkle it with dew.
Back when Coca-Cola really had Coke in it.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Yeah, yeah. It'll give you, put some pep in your step.
Sprinkle sprinkle cocaine on it. Give you aspergum some too. The pharmacist can.
We never figured out though why Reye syndrome happens though. But when the restrictions were put in, the incidence of Reye syndrome went down dramatically.
Oh yeah, there was definitely a connection there, and we know now not to use aspirin in children specifically with acute febrile illnesses. Still though, to this day, why the hell it happens and why it's a very pediatric entity. you know, rather than happening in older people. It's weird.
We already knew, as you mentioned, about the pain relieving and anti-inflammatory effects of aspirin. And by the time of 1950, it had entered the Guinness Book of World Records as the most frequently sold painkiller, a record I believe it still holds to this day, despite the fact that opioids exist.
No. Oh, I might put in there prescribed.
Yeah. Nope. Frequently sold.
Yeah. Or sorry, frequently sold. I don't know how much we're keeping track of like the sale of various opiates. Like, I don't know if we can put that down in a ledger. So I mean, opium may have an edge there if we were to try to count those.
But in 1950, just as aspirin was becoming the most debated sold Guinness World Record medication for painkiller, the effects on blood clotting, or aspirin as an antiplatelet agent, were first being noticed by a family doctor in California, Lawrence Craven. Now, he had been directing all of his tonsillectomy patients to chew aspergum, for the pain relief and anti-inflammatory. He's like, this is great. You know, you can work your jaw if you have your tonsils out. You know, it's a good introduction to the diet, and it'll be pain relieving. But he then found that an unusual number of patients had to be hospitalized for severe bleeding, often from the mouth. No, I kid. Horror movie appropriate. But no, seriously, severe bleeding. And all of those patients had been using very high amounts of aspergum. And as you mentioned, Eleanor, 3.5 grains, which is about 227 milligrams.
Exactly.
Wow. That's a nice dose.
See, yeah, fun with measurement.
Yeah, there we go.
Craven took one look at this and said, patients I'm giving aspergum seem to have a lot of bleeding. And he then did the next logical thing and began recommending daily aspirin to all his patients.
Wait, what?
Oh, great. They're bleeding out. Everybody, aspirin for everybody.
No. I mean, was he thinking of like heart attacks and strokes or?
He claimed that patients who followed his aspirin regime, about 8,000 people, had no signs of thrombosis.
But why would they normally? Was thrombosis a big thing back then?
He was a family doctor. He didn't know. He's just like, oh, this stops people from bleeding. Well, maybe not bleeding will prevent collapsing from literally anything. You know, 1950s. So what diseases did they have back then? Hysteria? That was still a thing.
It wasn't so far back. Yeah,
studies on the whole were not taken seriously by the medical community because he had never done a placebo-controlled study and had published only in obscure journals. So he was one of the first to hypothesize that blood thinners would be effective for cardiac prevention or protection. I don't know what his thoughts were on strokes. That was around 1950. And in 1971, John Vane, another professor of pharmacology at the University of London, first published research describing how aspirin worked, which is, to make it super short, dose-dependent inhibition of prostaglandin synthesis. I could go into this in more detail, but the guy won a Nobel Prize for this, so I'm not going to do it justice.
Well, no, but Eleanor, can you walk us through the mechanism?
Oh, you're really putting me on the spot here this evening.
As we said, Nobel Prize. Yeah. Eleanor, sum it up.
No, just in how the prostaglandins relate to inflammation.
Well, aspirin as well as nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory agents like Aleve and Motrin, they inhibit prostaglandin synthesis, which is involved in the inflammatory cascade. So if you're blocking that trigger to inflammation, that's how it's having its effect. I believe that also has some effects possibly as well in temperature regulation in the brain, which is why they work as an antipyretic as well.
And for those of you who haven't been, you know, sick of us talking about cytokine cascades back in the early days of COVID, again, you're dealing with the same kind of inflammatory cascades that aspirin inhibits. So that was, again, in the 70s. So it took 20 years when we first started noticing this anti-platelet activity to really figure out how aspirin worked. And then in 1974, the very first randomized trial of aspirin in the secondary prevention of death from heart attack showed a reduction in mortality of 12% at 6 months and 25% at 12 months. So very impressive, but the sample size was small enough that the results were deemed statistically inconclusive.
Interesting. Wow. Now it took over. So it was first, you know, that one guy in California, Mr. Tonsil guy in the 50s suggested there's an association with lack of thrombotic events, but it took another like 20, 25 years before an actual trial was initiated.
And that one wasn't statistically significant, even though it did show a positive result. Then in the 90s, we started doing cancer research studies, again, for the clotting aspects that you first suspected, Santosh. Mm-hmm. And all through the 90s, a lot of studies, the CAST, Chinese Acute Stroke Trial, the HOT treatment, Hypertension Optimal Treatment, finally, somebody who gets it. people, basically, a whole bunch of studies, you know, kind of continue to confirm, and aspirin still remains one of the most studied drugs on the planet for all the things we are continuing to learn that it can do. But the 90s really was a big benefit when it showed it was an ideal medication for strokes, heart attacks, and really just a good all-around low dose. It also began to be realized that at higher doses, which is what had been sold before, you'd see much greater incidence of side effects such as stomach irritation, ulcer development, and presumably some of the effects we talked about, some of the other problems we talked about earlier, which is why the 81 or baby aspirin dose was not created. You know, Santosh, you want to tell us what it's baby aspirin?
Yeah. So that's the orange flavor too. Yeah. This is the standard child aspirin dose. Back when we thought pediatrics, you know, kids were just small adults, when we would just go like, oh, you know, less person, less medicine, you know, kind of thing. So it was this weird cutoff that like a child from age 4 months old all the way to 18 would have the same exact dose because, hey, they're kids. So it got labeled as baby or child's aspirin. This is one that I'm actually very intimately involved with because our institution studies Kawasaki disease, which is a inflammation of the arteries. We don't understand what triggers it, but it is very rare. And this is an inflammatory disease where our body starts to attack our own medium-sized arteries, which includes the coronaries in the heart. So it happens, you know, it's like X per 100,000. It's very, very low incidence. And it has been talked about a lot lately because of COVID. We saw this weird other syndrome called Miss C, which was for a while associated with Kawasaki disease. We now know it's not. We know it's a separate thing, also heavily inflammatory. So you give aspirin for this. And before we had other anti-inflammatory modalities, this was the rescue for Kawasaki's because you would halt the inflammatory cascade and then you would hopefully also reduce the chances of that inflammation causing the coronaries to actually turn into an aneurysm and blow out and either have a clot kind of build up in there or rupture. So this is how we, you know, one of the ways that we learned how intimately inflammation and clotting were tied together were with the targeted treatment of this specific, very rare disease, Kawasaki disease.
So if the 90s were the big time to encourage more and more use of aspirin as it prevented clotting, then the early 2000s, all the way up through about 2015, really focused on the cancer aspects, the, again, anti-clotting, but rather than your cardiovascular system, looking what did the reduced risk of cancer mean for tumor spread in vascular or in the vasculature. So a meta-analysis of 8 clinical trials found after about 5 years of follow-up, people who took aspirin daily for a mean of 4 years had a 44% reduced risk of dying from cancer compared with participants who took a placebo. Now, again, that what does it mean in this case to die from cancer? They were looking at clotting events that could be directly traced to having a pro-clotting condition like cancer. So heart attack, if you're in a late stage of cancer, would still have counted. Pulmonary embolism or a clot in your lungs also would have counted. It's not that the cancer itself was prevented by the aspirin.
But I thought there was data that actually aspirin can prevent like colon cancer, I think.
That showed up in 2013.
Okay.
And that was a
reference burn
from the Women's Health Study. So let me mansplain this study to you, Eleanor.
Yeah, please do.
It was son of a bitch. How dare you?
It was a large primary prevention trial among women that initially suggested aspirin lowers the risk of stroke without affecting the risk of heart attack or other cardiovascular death. So that was the general one. It continued all the way up through 2013, and that showed that among the other benefits, long-term use of alternate day low-dose aspirin did result in a 42% reduction in colorectal cancer incidence with, for unclear reasons, at least as opposed to vasculature, but benefits appear after 10 years. It also showed increased risk of GI bleeding and ulcers, which makes sense given what we already know. But that's why I was asking if you knew anything about the tinnitus, because it's just not something I've tracked, and I had honestly forgotten that was a side effect of aspirin use.
Yeah, it's chronic. It's with chronic high-dose use that you can see it. But it's not that frequent because we're not routinely overdosing people on aspirin, I think, number one. And I think probably if you look today at the what is probably the more commonly used medications for like general inflammation, it's probably going to be non-steroidals like Motrin and Aleve, not so much aspirin. Aspirin nowadays is more relegated towards, you know, the cardiac patient and possibly, you know, for anti-cancer prevention. But, you know, I just don't see aspirin used quite as much as it used to be in the past. So maybe it has fallen from its Guinness Book of World Records, you know, record back in 1950.
So you're saying that aspirin is now moving to a younger, hipper crowd or less hipper replacement. and that's largely because results from studies like ARRIVE and ASPRE, ASPRE is aspirin in reducing events in the elderly, and ARRIVE is aspirin to reduce risk of initial vascular events, have shown that in people who have high risk of bleeds, aspirin's harms may outweigh its benefits. And especially in older people who often have hearing and vision problems that can affect balance, who are at higher risk of strokes, but equally high risk of brain bleeds if they are incorrectly dosing medication due to other memory issues. So, as you're right, aspirin is starting to fall slightly out of favor, although that doesn't mean that it's not recommended or used, just that a lot more thought is put into, you know, would you rather have somebody die of a stroke from a traveling clot to their brain or from a bleed in their brain after falling down only 2 stairs because their blood was thin enough to prevent the one. So it's a real devil's bargain. But let's end on a happier note and go back to talking about aspergum and just the story of gum in general. So as I said, the Retro Brands USA does plan to relaunch the brand, although I don't know if 2020 interfered with that. But I went on a whole wiki dive about medical gum in this, and it was a huge field for a while. They were creating numbing gums, aspirin gums, like any medicine you could shove into a rubber chewy form was in it. And the Mayans were not too far behind the Greeks in developing the custom of chewing gum. In around the 2nd century, they practiced an art of chewing that was later to be known as chicle, the coagulated sap of the sapodilla tree. So they would deliver plant medicines through chiclets.
Oh, chiclets.
Yeah. Well, or rather, chiclets were named for chicle.
Yes. Yeah. And the modern day gum products date back to 1869 when General Santa Anna was using a chicle tree for this purpose. So he found it as rubber. But all of that is incidental. I just like that we have the Mayans invented chiclets, the Greeks invented, you know, masticating or the ancient art of chewing gum, and that a family doctor is like, a lot of people that chew this gum or bleeding, I better prescribe it to everybody. That's real forward thinking.
Yeah, it is.
Science.
So the next time somebody tells you about Hippocrates being the discoverer of aspirin or willow bark, you have a whole bunch of fun aspirin facts to toss back at them. And we encourage you to do it.
Yeah, we'll look forward to all of you sending us your marriage stories.
And
you remember how we met when I when you corrected my misconception about the history of aspirin? Aww.
And I had more Bam Lim and Afabab song follow-ups for you.
Yay.
That had been submitted to us.
That's so awesome. People submitted Bam Lam and Bam Lam and Vab. Bam
Lam. I put out a call for other songs that would work with COVID antibody drug Bam Lam Ivamab.
Yeah, wham bam bam
lam. Yeah.
Wop up.
Eleanor, if you haven't listened to it already, Josh's favorite is the song Black Betty by Ram Jam.
Yep.
So, whoa, Black Betty, bam-a-lam. So, and thanks to him, I can't go to my COVID committee meetings anymore on the pharmacy and therapeutic side because I start giggling like an idiot.
So one of them was, if you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Bam, lam, vamab.
Okay.
It was a real soft rock or ballad one.
Yeah.
Is it Little Richard who would go wop bop doo bop 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 bam boom?
Wop bop boom. Bam, lam, lam. Bam, lam, lam, bop, bam, boom.
Bam,
boom.
Bam,
yeah,
bam,
sure.
Lam, lam.
That works really well. Did
and
someone...
I can't fight this Bam Lam Avab anymore. Sorry, I misread the lyric. And I can't fight this COVID anymore. I've forgotten what Bam Lam Avab is for. Appreciate that they sent me the couplet.
There's a little bit of liberty taken with this, but I can't fault anybody because no one knows how to pronounce the goddamn thing. The people who have named it and discovered it don't know how to pronounce it properly.
If only we could go back to Aspergum. It's
exactly.
Simple. It tells you what it did. Bam Lama Gum.
And it's orange or cherry flavored.
or the NyQuil green death flavor.
Oh, yes. Oh, no. You know what's the most disgusting thing as a kid? Do you remember a drug, or it wasn't even really a drug, called Emitrol?
What was it?
Oh, man, that was some nasty stuff. You know what it tasted like? It was supposed to kind of settle a kid's stomach if they had, like, you know, if they were vomiting. And I think all it was like a hypertonic sugar solution. But all I remember is it tasted like licking the back of an envelope. Like that.
Oh.
Stamp taste that they don't really have anymore, but it was just, oh man. It's like, no, it would induce vomiting, not really stop vomiting.
That's that glue, like that sweet glue flavor.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, my favorite one. We are young. No one can tell us we're wrong. Love's a bam, lam, and mav-a-vav.
Okay. That was Love is a Battlefield.
Yep.
Yo. Someone's gonna come at us with a lawsuit. Was it all shorter than 8 seconds? Are we okay?
I think my mispronunciations and educational use ought to cover us.
Oh,
but
my Lord.
Keep submitting them. Let's give Santosh a coronary, and then we can slip him some Aspergum.
Exactly.
You see, folks, it's all connected.
You're a bad person.
That's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. The show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. Extra special thanks to pharmacist O'Ranger for her expertise. And
yay! Ooh, Eleanor, do you think we could have you back sometime soon to do a COVID update?
Talk about that bam a bam a lamb.
Yeah.
And now you know why she's a friend of the show. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Ledger.
Oh, I hate you.
If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links to some of the sources used in researching this episode. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Audible, or wherever quality podcasts are found. And until next time, as always, stay safe, wash your hands, mask up, and if you have the ability to and are lucky enough, happy travels.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.